just make sure you click record to cloud and we're good.
Okay, it seems it works much more smoothly now as opposed to in the past. It used to,
yep.
I clicked on it and it's sort of, it looks like it is recording, so.
All right.
Okay, we'll give it a couple of more minutes and then we will get started. Yeah. Okay, I'll call out a couple of names which I don't recognize, or, you know, probably you are new. Baibu Zhang, if you can, you know, introduce yourself quickly.
Hi, I'm Baibu. I'm a researcher at BMO Financial Groups. I'm very interested to see how the AI fairness thing is going out. Excited to join the meeting.
Thanks, Baibu, and welcome. I'm sorry, where did you mention you are doing your research?
BMO, Bank of Montreal Financial Groups.
Okay, Bank of Montreal Financial Group. Thanks, and welcome to the Trusted AI meeting. Hiram Anderson.
Hi, I'm Hiram Anderson. I work for Microsoft in a trustworthy machine learning group and am a huge fan of the Adversarial Robustness Toolkit and have been using that for a while. So very excited to join and see what's happening in the Linux Foundation.
Great, thanks. Thanks a lot and welcome, Hiram. I believe there is the FairLearn initiative as well, right, which is going on at Microsoft, right? It would be glad, you know, if someone who can at some point, you know, present that, you know, toolkit to this Trusted AI committee.
So I'm involved in tangentially with FAIR, but also the internal committee at Microsoft called Ether, which is for AI ethics at Microsoft.
Okay. Great. So yeah, I mean, we would love to, you know, if at some point you would like to, you know, propose and present on some of these efforts to whatever, you know, you can do externally, that will be great.
Sure. Happy to propose that.
Thanks. Jacob?
Hello. So my name is Jacob Bond. I'm at General Motors. I spent some time in the vehicle cybersecurity group. Now I'm a researcher in the Perception, Planning, and Decision Systems group.
Okay, welcome, Jacob.
I also spent some good time with the Adversarial Robustness Toolbox and think it's a great tool.
Thanks. Great to hear that. I'm pretty sure, you know, Beat is smiling in the background. Will Pierce?
Hi, sorry, I just joined. I'm Will Pierce. I work at Microsoft on the Adversarial Trustworthy Machine Learning team. Basically, I attack machine learning from an ops perspective inside Microsoft.
Okay, that's great. So, welcome. It's great to see, you know, Microsoft, you know, participating more in these activities. And you know, as I mentioned, you know, it will be awesome to have your group present at some point, right? Obviously, with the efforts going on at your end. Okay, thanks. So I think we will get started on this side, right? So I think in general, excuse me, a couple of pointers versus, you know, the meeting schedules. So as of now, you know, we have moved this meeting, which is the North America / you know, Europe time zone, to be monthly every fourth Thursday of the month. And that's how, you know, we will pursue this. there will be another Asia-friendly meeting, right, which Saishruti is going to coordinate and get a time slot, you know, agreed on and get going on the schedule as well. So that will happen every second Thursday of the month. But for most of the North America and Europe time zone, you know, this is the meeting time slot, which will, what we will be using every fourth Thursday. With that, you know, the, if you are not aware of, in general, right, any of the LFAI entry points for these different projects, right, the meeting note is where I've been sort of, you know, compiling them. So if you, look from that perspective, right, you should be able to find, you know, the entry point for all the links in the project. So I will ping it in the chat as well, right? So one meeting note which can be used in terms of, you know, gaining entry to these projects. I would then have, you know, Stacy. She leads some of our engagements with real world customers to actually go through the efforts, you know, she's driving in the community from that perspective, and talk about, you know, how she is interfacing with more so and what kind of use cases she is seeing in the financial industry around trusted AI, both with a combination of open source as well as, you know, some of the work, more advanced work, which is internal to IBM. So she's part of IBM, the data science team, right, which interfaces and works a lot with the customers in the industry. So Stacy, if you do want to, you know, get started and share.
Cool. Thanks for having me. Let me do some screen sharing. There we go. All right, has that kicked off successfully? All right, so thanks again for having me. As mentioned, I'm a data scientist with an IBM. So I work directly with our clients on their data. And I also am an advocate for responsible or ethical AI. And so everything around fairness and explainability are very passionate topics for me. And so I was very lucky to be involved in a project at a financial institute, a bank. And so I'm gonna kind of talk you through what they were looking for, provide a bit of scope of what we were there to do, then, you know, how we did it and some lessons learned. So the bank itself, oh, why can't I change? Oh, it's got a fancy thingy on it. There we go. The bank themselves, were looking for a managing platform for their model lifecycle. So it wasn't just trustworthy AI where my focus was. They were looking for a solution that really can help them through their 2,000 plus models across the enterprise. And these models provide decisions for things like consumer banking, wealth management, capital markets, and involve billions of dollars of transactions. So it's really important that these models do well. And when they're trying to put their models into deployment, they have this auditing process. And that also includes assessing whether the models themselves are interpretable. So many models at this client were not in production. So a lot of work was done, you know, in pre-production and building in these models, but they were too complicated, you know, too complex to understand. And so developers and consequently users wouldn't be able to explain why a prediction was made. So there were two tracks to the project. So the first was the governance around model risk management. So we were showcasing capabilities for compliance and operational policies. And then the track that I'm going to discuss, my focus was this trustworthy AI track. And we mostly, the work that we did was on explainability. We did touch on a little bit about fairness, but that wasn't really within the scope of this particular work. And for that, the reason that they wanted to do it is they wanted to create an explainability center to support model developers across the organization, deploy more models and, you know, give them resources for explainability. So they wanted to kind of be an internal consulting arm that, you know, when this auditing process comes up, or even during development phase, when data scientists are building stuff, they have somewhere to go to make sure that, you know, they're not going to go too far before they can't explain a model and they know it won't get taken to production. So the scope of the project was to demonstrate explainability for around 10 different machine learning models covering up to 6 different questions. So I've captured the main 4 here. And so that's global explainability. So what characteristics does the model deem to be important? So at that general level, you know, which, if it's column the data, which features, if it's text, which words. Local explainability. So for this particular example, why do we believe the decision was made? Counterfactuals, you know, how can you change the outcome? So what could I do to get my bank loan or, you know, whatever it is, how could I change it? Is that fair? Is that within a reasonable bound? We also had sensitivity, which is kind of the, how can I remain within this category? So, you know, if I can get a loan, like how much can I, wiggle room do I have of increasing the amount I'm asking for? Then we had consistency or similarity, which was, you know, looking at, do examples similar to me or, you know, to a particular text, do they also have the same outcome? And then in terms of the input data, it was a wide range. So it was, you know, structured, both static and sequential, unstructured, with text and images. And so the bank were testing for as many different algorithms and data types as possible because they wanted to cover as many requirements they expected to see from the organization. So some of the models were built on bank data, internal data to them, and others on open data. And in terms of algorithm, again, it was a range. So we had, you know, XGBoost model and many deep learning models with various different types of layers. The natural language also varied a little. So we had TF-IDF and we also had GloVe embeddings. And then libraries as well were a range. So scikit-learn, XGBoost, TensorFlow, Keras, and PyTorch. So again, they just wanted to make sure that if a model was being built in the company, they wanted to see what solutions were available out there. So I got to be an interface between the client and IBM Research for AIX360, but also with our product tool as well. And I'll just kind of go over the different solutions that we used. So for local explainability, we use IBM's Watson OpenScale. An alternative to this, if OpenScale hadn't been available, would be, you know, Lime or Sharp within AIX360. But we obviously are trying to showcase our platform, and that was within our platform. Global explainability, we use an aggregation of Watson OpenScale's local explainability, as well as AIX360i, so an internal library, explainability library to IBM, S-ratio. The S-ratio algorithm creates a more interpretable machine learning model, so a regression or a tree-based model, but encourage it to focus on examples that the more complicated model is able to predict. So this results in an improved interpretable model that can be used as a proxy for the more complex initial model that they would have built. For counterfactuals, we use multiple algorithms depending on the type of data. So for structured classification data, we had out of the box Watson OpenScale. For structured regression, we had AIX360i, again, this internal library, likelihood comprehension. And so that was used to advise how changing income, input data, so changing particular features, would move the outcome towards a target number. For text, we had AIX360i's CTM algorithm. And so that replaces words in the sentence based upon their embedding or their semantic similarity. And then for images, we had AIX360's 2 libraries. So we had CEM, which answers which pixels could be added to change the class, while CEMMAF answers which features could be added to change the class. So the second is more intuitive to a human, as this, you know, if it's a shoe, for example, like to make it from a shoe to a boot, you could add more fabric above the ankle. Or if it's a number, if it's 0 to a 9, you're adding a line to the bottom of the 0. So that's more intuitive for a human. But if you were thinking of adversarial attacks, maybe just understanding which pixels at that level would cause problems to your model, that would be sufficient. So there's 2 different purposes, and we demonstrated both. For similarity, we use AIX360's ProtoDash, and this was a great solution. It covered so many different types of algorithms, and it's designed to find prototypes within the data. So diverse examples that best represent the entire population. So you first find the one example that best represents your population. Then when you look for the second one, you want it to be the best representation of that population, but still as far away as possible from the first one you found, to make sure that you're capturing different patterns in the data. So it can be used to answer the similarity question, because it's finding prototypes in the wider data similar to a particular data point. So again, it's saying, okay, what's the most similar example in the data point to this data point? And then when it's searching for a second one, it's like, what's the next most similar, moving as far away from that first data point as possible. So these are all great solutions, and I want to share with you some lessons learned from it though. So the first one was pretty much a justification for this project, and that explainability means different things to different people and provides different benefits. So, you know, knowing which features are generally deemed important, so our global scenario, can highlight if a model is doing something unexpected, or it can guide data engineering in terms of prioritizing features to be consistent. Whilst counterfactuals provide guidance on how the outcome can be changed, so that might be more important for a particular individual. So this just again kind of confirmed that, and was a discussion we had in terms of when this project was being evaluated. It was being evaluated by data scientists or people that would potentially be in this team, but they might want to think about, you know, who is going to be using this after, you know, in production, or who's going to need for this explainability to make sense to them, not necessarily someone technical. It might be, an end user. So the client also expected that a lot of these questions would be solved out of the box. But unfortunately, there's a lot of nuances for each model. And again, to the second point, how a person defines a successful evaluation is nuanced as well, and again comes back to who the persona is. So for an example, we have our text classification counterfactual solution. It easily flipped the class by changing a word or two, but which was the initial kind of question, you know, what word do I need to change? And it satisfied that happily. However, when the team reviewing it were looking at it, they didn't understand why that word would make the difference. So if you're concerned about adversarial attacks, maybe just an intuitive word or a random pixel in an image is all you require, because, you know, how robust is this model? But if you're explaining it to a human, how they could rephrase something to get the outcome they need, then this isn't sufficient. So because they wanted a more human intuitive response, then we looked to exploring thresholds. So changing, you know, the confidence of the class has to be above a certain threshold. So it's not just kind of a neutral word that replaces a stronger word, it's more a word towards a different class. And then when providing the explainability scenarios, like I said, the appropriate persona or person that would be using the solution should be involved in the evaluation and high parameter tuning phase, rather than just the data scientist. It needs to make sure that it's gonna meet the requirements of those that will ask for that explainability when the time comes. And so one thing here was, when you're optimizing supervised machine learning, you have a specific mathematical metric you're focused on. So your accuracy or your mean absolute error, whatever it is that's important to you. So you can almost brute force this mathematically. It's, you know, you're gonna run a grid or a random search and change it from hyperparameters, see which one reduces your error rate, and then move towards that, try again. And you can pretty much automate this to a certain extent. However, with explainability, the outcome must align with kind of this human intuition. So the human, and I worry about the word intuition, it's a bit fluffy. I definitely need a better word to capture that. But ultimately, a human needs to be involved in this process. So, you know, it's definitely going to be more time consuming than hyperparameter tuning with machine learning, but also risks introducing their bias. So just because the one person evaluating it thinks this explanation makes sense doesn't mean everyone does. So we found that interesting, because it was going to require a bit more of a process for how are you going to keep the human in the loop? Are you going to have some sort of user acceptance testing with multiple users to make sure it, you know, explainability makes sense for a group of people? But it also was a bit of a surprise to the client that we had to do this back and forth to meet their needs. And things like within images, there's something that says, you know, how many pixels you can change. It's kind of a regularization for the number of pixels that you will allow it to change. And actually a human needs more pixels to change for it to make sense of them. So we had to kind of play that around a little bit. And again, it was trade-off between different hyperparameters as well. And then finally, the explain the explainability. So throughout the evaluation by the client, they were checking if the explanations made sense to them. but they explicitly asked, do we have a way to explain the explanations? And of course, this could lead down quite a rabbit hole because, you know, if you explain that, you need to explain that and keep explaining all the explanations. But just as you wish to trust machine learning models, you also want to make sure you can trust the explainability algorithms for them. So for local explainability, we found that providing the global explanations using an aggregate of those local explanations was sufficient because ultimately how the human was doing it was looking at examples and seeing if they could find a pattern themselves. So any way that we could show them what the general pattern was kind of helps them feel more comfortable with it. But again, that becomes like a generalization. But for image classification, global explainability was out of scope. And during their evaluation process, they were kind of looking for that because they pick kind of tens of each individual class, and then they would kind of look at them, see, you know, what sort of features seem to map out in the explainability and kind of be looking for those patterns. So this led to some discussion on potential benefits of saliency-based highlighting. So there's definitely something there of like these, all these libraries and like algorithms are wonderful and they have met the requirement of the question, but how do you also ensure that we can build trust with the explainability algorithms themselves so they get used more widely? And there are similar conversations here around counterfactuals as well, were the patterns in determining which words were changing. And again, like I said, in images, pixels, what were the pixels that were being changed? So ultimately, I think there can be some further research in this space, but it was a really beneficial project for the client to kind of understand what capabilities are out there and start to capture that ready for when they build out this team. It was a great experience for us to learn and extend, you know, learn from what the needs are in the industry and kind of extend some of the algorithms that we have to kind of meet those requirements. So there was some kind of tweaking here and there, which I was glad to be doing. And I feel very grateful for the team at IBM Research that supported this effort. And I think that's all I have. Yep, that is it from me. Any questions?
Thanks a lot, Stacey. I think that was great to learn. One of the quick questions I had was, you know, you mentioned the AIX360 CTM on your second last slide, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to picture it in the context of, you know, of an Asian industry use case, right? The AIX360 ICTM and likelihood comprehension. Yeah, I believe this is, what do you think, or from your perspective, right, was there more something more concrete in the context of financial industry where this was used?
I think it's text again. So this was kind of within the bank. They have emails that they need to flag up as complaints, for example. So, you know, what are the words that the model understands to be complaints and what does it not? That's kind of the context in which we were looking at it. But not all these examples were, they shared with us what their true banking scenario was. They would sometimes find us open data projects to work with as well. But I think it's kind of not just explicit to banking, but, you know, generally like email classification, what made it class, you know, what sent these emails to the right team to resolve them and what didn't. So I think it's just more broadly, I can't think of anything more explicitly within the financial industry, but more broadly in terms of customer interaction, basically.
Okay, thanks. Anyone else has any questions? Okay. If not,
I was looking for the mute button. I had one. what tools what gaps did you find that existed in the current tooling suites for testing?
So, what do you mean by testing for the client evaluating it?
For client evaluation model explainability, things like that.
So, I think a lot of the a lot of the algorithms, they do what they say they will do. They get you an example that changes a class, or they tell you which things you can do. But we had to kind of get that into a way that was presentable to the client. So it could just be, here's some examples. So for ProtoDash, it was literally just serve up the examples to the client, the most similar to the text. But one of them, we had this really big, large text, you know, it's like hundreds to thousands of words. And so when you're looking for similarity in such a giant document, it was hard to kind of understand. You had to really read them and then read the other one and be like, oh, are they the same? I'm not sure. So then we looked at kind of what are the overlapping words or similar words. And we tried to kind of put a bit of a design head on it to be like, okay, how do we best serve this up to the client? And as I mentioned, right now, the client, we're just data scientists, but it's definitely something that needs to be considered in terms of how do you serve this up to whoever will be the end user. With images, so like OpenScale provides the pixels, or you know, if it's changing, it tells you which you need to change. But like I said, so it's even for like CEM and CMMAF, when we came into that conversation of why, like why does, yes, okay, you've shown me that these pixels are the reason it's in this class, but I still don't know the why. Then we had to serve up like 20 examples of one class to be like, oh, now you can have a look at this to see, rather than them run a notebook or, you know, whatever code we gave them multiple times to see one and remember what it looked like and then take a screenshot, we tried to kind of create a solution where it kind of put a few of them in front of them so they could evaluate it at one time. So there's definitely a design aspect, and I think that would change by client, and as I said, who's going to be using this. And we had to definitely consider that, because the examples we have, which are great, I have no complaints, and I love the research team for supporting this effort, but they do what they need to do to get a white paper out and, you know, celebrate this stuff with the world. And then just to try and tweak it to make it meet every business need is not necessary within a scope, which is where I came in. So there was that kind of just customization to meet this kind of slightly different model, or like I said, this human intuition-y bit, like how, again, with the text one, playing around with that threshold to make it more human intuitive. And at the moment, that was kind of back and forth, like, okay, we've tweaked this. Does this now look sufficient to you? And they go and look at different examples, and then we come back. And I think there's definitely some scope in that hyperparameter evaluation process of like how best to serve it up to them with these tweaks, or whether it's something we could make more easy for them to do themselves rather than have to push back. But we only had this lasted maybe 12 weeks or maybe longer, maybe 16 total. And so even I couldn't learn every single algorithm here as thoroughly as I would like. And so the client certainly couldn't either. But I would hope that if they were going to be an explainability team, then they would put a lot of focus into that. So they would really know how these things work, what their strengths are, what the limitations are, how they need to hyperparameter tune. Well, does that answer your question? I feel like I just rambled.
No, it does. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
I had another question. Explaining the output of an inference to a different actor in a different role, you know, requires different information potentially. And that's been observed, you know, in other forums in which I participated. My hypothesis is that the comparative differences of the underlying population in the training set versus the population as a whole is a indicator for many subject matter experts who aren't data scientists. For example, you know, in a clinical trial, as you may or may not be aware, most of the subjects are male. Right, that's never really articulated as a differentiation. But I'm wondering, in your explanation of these answers to the various actors and their different roles, did the concept of the actual population in the training set become an explanatory component?
Okay, so when like you mean
the ages, the race, the sex, the level of income, you know, like this was good at predicting defaults, and we only looked at white men over 50 living in California making over $100,000 a year. Right. I'm wondering how, if any of that became part and parcel of trying to explain these inferences.
So for this scope of the project, we didn't have anything that had any sensitive attributes like that, which is why at the beginning I said trustworthy AI, and I would capture fairness in that. And I feel like what you're alluding to would be more along, or would definitely want to be a focus on fairness. I feel like explainability would highlight that as well. If you found the gender was the most important feature to alone, then that would be problematic and something that you'd
It doesn't have to be protected attributes. It could be, you know, the size of the images, right? This was all trained on 4K images, and this was trained on, you know, 244 by 244 images.
Yeah, true.
I'm just wondering if that was a part of the explanation to your various targets and your audiences.
I mean, so for this project, we only have the training data. We didn't have anything that would be considered production data. So any nuance between, you know, the distribution or input data versus what was being seen in production wasn't something we had the opportunity to explore. But I think you're definitely right. There's definitely value there in terms of, and even if you had explanations of this is how your model's doing, explaining it on the training data, and you found completely different explanations on your test data, that'd be quite fascinating, or in production data. But we didn't have access to that. We only had training data for this project.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot, Stacey. In interest of time, we will move to the other topics on the agenda. So I'll probably go to Beat. If you want to quickly, you know, give an update on the adversarial robustness toolbox kit, Beat, that'll be great.
Hi, Animesh. Hello, everybody. My name is Beat Puse. I have a few slides that I could share.
Please go ahead, Beat.
Okay. Are you able to see my slide?
Yeah, we are able to, and let's try to keep this between 5 and 10 minutes so that, you know, we will be able to get to the other things as well. So that's great. Yeah, we can see that.
Okay, good. I'll not talk about all the slides. I'll just highlight a few things. So that's kind of a slide deck that describes the current state of the adversarial robustness toolbox. And I also would like to say thank you to all the nice words that the people have said at the beginning about art. This is a great motivation to the team. I also make sure that the rest of the team hears about it. So basically what ART currently does is covers four different adversarial threats. So it started with evasion, soon went into poisoning threats. And in the last 12 months, we added extraction threats and cover now inference threat with the most recent release of ART 1.3, 1.4. And it's kind of a visualization here on how these threats relate to training data and trained machine learning models, how a malicious user can interfere with these model pipelines. We all know that these are probably real adversarial threats. So I can probably quickly skip over this slide. And here at this slide, I would take a quick break. We show here real vulnerability nodes that fall into the adversarial threats that ART is covering. But I have to say the most recent one, the vulnerability node covering the Proofpoint email protection evaluation. We have added it, but we don't have it on this version of the slide. And I'm very excited today to see Will Pierce on this call, who did a lot of work around the vulnerability node. And we were very interested to follow his work and his presentations around that vulnerability, which is combining an extraction and an evasion attack to fool an email protection system. And this brings us also to the motivation where we want to go with ART covering all these different adversarial threats. It's really that the combination of these threats become more dangerous than just a single threat by itself. So for example, if you are able to kind of extract the behavior of a machine learning model and then use the extracted model to stage an evasion attack in the second step to then really break the defense of a system. This is a quick summary. I think we can skip this slide. This is basically the big overview of where we are now. So we see ART as a Python library for machine learning security, covering all the popular machine learning frameworks. And in the last, let's say the releases since 1.2, we are now at 1.4, preparing 1.5. We really wanted to go to cover all possible machine learning tasks, so go beyond the initial classification. We are now going beyond the initial focus on images. So we really want to cover table, or we are already covering tables, audio, video. And with 1.5, we will also start to cover or support multimodal data. Okay, and yeah, as you know, we are now on GitHub and the Trusted AI organization. This is a quick overview of the activity that we had in the last two releases. So you can see nearly in all the areas in attacks and defenses in the four different adversarial threats, we have added new tools or improvements of the performance of existing tools. And we are expecting to grow in, I think, all of these areas. One of the most recent additions is the inference threat. So we have there now the established, or let's say, well-discussed attacks in the literature for model inversion, attribute inference, and membership inference. And we are also tracking the progress in the literature there. This brings me to the last slide. Maybe I can already skip to the colored version, which is the roadmap for ART. So at the top, you really see how ART has progressed over the last 2 years. And the big focus of the last release in September 2020 was the introduction of support for automated speech recognition, and where we have introduced the imperceptible ASR attack and the first estimator for deep speech version 2 in PyTorch. And we plan to, with the version of ART 1.5, which we will plan to release end of November, early December, we plan to expand on these ASR capabilities by introducing an easy to use ART estimator for the Lingvo ASR model. We also plan, we'll introduce support for multimodal inputs. The scenario that we try to support there is satellite data that has different ranges and different channels, as an example. And also we will bring new state-of-the-art attacks and baselines, several attacks and defenses in for the poisoning threat will be part of 1.5. For 1.6, that's, we plan that currently for February, March, in that range, there we'll expand on the support for physical world threat models. But there we are thinking and planning in the direction of more realistic physical patches on, and how to create them, and also how to defend against them. Also support for models with discrete inputs, improved support. So far we can only handle really very special cases. And there we are also thinking in the direction of text as inputs. And something I also forgot to mention, something that we think is very exciting that we'll be adding to ART 1.5 is a new module called ART.evaluations. That builds on top of the existing attacks, which are mostly there to create adversarial examples. But ART.evaluations will build on top of these tools to provide more detailed evaluation tools or algorithms for evaluations that go beyond just creating adversarial examples, but will build up on top of the ART.attacks tools. Beyond that, we are very interested in use cases in cybersecurity and forensics, also end-to-end evaluations. That's, we are thinking in the direction of automated adaptive attacks. Also novel tasks like regression and reinforcement learning are being discussed. And also general performance and usability improvements are on the way. So for example, in ART 1.5 will be the first version where we will have full differentiation through the model and pre-processing defenses using the framework's automated differentiation tools. So far, we always had to, that it comes from the very early versions of ART, do backward differentiations through defenses in NumPy to be framework independent. ARC 1.5 will be the first one that provides full differentiation for TensorFlow 2 and PyTorch. That should also be a big performance upgrade there. So with that, I think that's the last slide I have. And yeah, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Beat. I was told, you know, I'm pronouncing your name wrong. Is Beat the right way to say it?
Yeah, that's perfect. But no worries. That happens.
Thanks. I'm glad that, you know. So, any questions from the community on this?
Beat, this is Hiram. It's excellent work. I'm a big fan of the tool. Of the toolbox and how it stacks up against others. It's just not a comparison. I'm wondering if this roadmap and these slides are publicly available on the Git repo or elsewhere?
I don't think they are right now, but I think we probably should be able to make it publicly accessible.
One thing I would say, Hiram, is like, you know, I pinged the meeting doc, right? So what I would do is, you know, after the meeting, you know, reach out to the folks and see, you know, get either the slides as is or, you know, subset of these slides and add the links there, right? So, you know, so if you do want to follow that, you know, that would be great. And otherwise, BH, you can also use the Slack channel, right, for art and post it there.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, I just... If you are interested in kind of the more detailed, in the details of the roadmap, we also have all the detail of the planning in Zenhub boards on GitHub for the different version projects, where you really can see fine-grained activities for each release.
Great. We're relying, so I work with Will Pierce at Microsoft. We're relying on this toolkit for a number of things, including training data, but also in our red team ops, we're providing wrappers around the functionality there to, you know, scale sort of like a Mimikatz for security pen testing.
Oh, that sounds very interesting.
This is Jacob Bond at General Motors. I totally agree. It's a great toolbox. I'm excited to hear about these evaluations that are coming in 1.5. We're trying to work to get some of our suppliers to start using these to test their models before they provide them to us. So having an easier way to get our suppliers to evaluate these models would be great.
Okay. Yeah, we are definitely also thinking in that direction to kind of reduce the barrier to using the tool so that you don't need to know like the details of all the arguments of a sophisticated attack, that probably the evaluation tools can then be the entry point to art for general users.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, because especially as you get down to some of the smaller suppliers, they don't always have somebody that knows the AI and the security. So getting an easier way for them to do that is awesome.
The version that we have for 1.5 will probably have a few tools, but we definitely plan to grow that module, and we probably expect it to be the fastest growing module over the next few releases. So even if you don't find the tool immediately in 1.5, it's very likely that we will see it in other releases afterwards. And also, if you have a specific idea for a new tool, then yeah, please also, I would like to encourage everybody to make feature requests or also pull requests if you have already implemented a new feature.
Jacob, this is Animesh, right? I mean, if you can send a quick email, you know, in terms of areas where you think, you know, there needs to be more usability improvements and more so also, you know, which part of the life cycle you are using it mostly. Is it after training to do validation, or is it, you know, more in real-time inferencing scenarios where you want or trying to, you know, detect adversarial attacks? That would be great. So I think if we can you know, just send a quick email, the areas where you think that need to improvement, we can start following on it and you know, figure out, you know, what else can be done to improve the usability aspects.
Okay, will do. Who should I send the email to?
Excuse me, I ping my email ID there. Beat, you can ping your email ID there as well. If you can, you know, send to both of us, we can take it forward from there.
Awesome, will do.
Thanks a lot. So we're sort of, you know, reaching towards the end of the time, so we probably wouldn't be able to cover all the things in the agenda. So maybe Vijay, given that, you know, you're working out of the India time zone, it would be great to get a quick update from you on AI explainability, and then maybe Sam after that on AI fairness.
Sure, yeah. I'll just share my screen.
It's taking a while, Vijay. I think there is some technical issue. We can get started with something else.
Yeah, I think I've not used Zoom frequently, so it's better if Sam goes in before me. I'll just fix the issue by then.
Okay, that's fine. Sam? Okay.
Yeah, let me give it a try. Okay, is this working? So I just have the one little slide here, the quick update. So it should be pretty fast. So this is for AI Fairness 360. This is our algorithmic fairness detection, bias detection, and mitigation toolbox. Just a quick update of the past like month or so, and the immediate upcoming roadmap here. So we had 6 PRs in the past month merged. These were mostly just like small fixes, but we also have a couple larger things almost ready. So we have one algorithm, the Metafair classifier, which has been re-implemented and drastically sped up. That one's under review as a PR, and a couple ports of existing algorithms for our scikit-learn interface are also close to ready. So for the immediate upcoming month or two, our big goals are porting all of the legacy TensorFlow code from version 1 to TensorFlow 2 for compatibility and reasons, and as well as continuing the work on fleshing out the R and scikit-learn interfaces to the API.
Thanks a lot, Sam. That's great. I'm excited to see, you know, in more, you know, compatibility with the scikit-learn ecosystem emerging. And it would be great to, you know, in one of the follow-on sessions to have Saishruti talk about, you know, the uptake and the use cases which she has been seeing on the R community side. So with that, Vijay, if you are still figuring that out, I can have is Andrew there on the call?
Yeah.
No, I can.
Oh, you're
either
you're...
way.
Okay, go ahead, Vijay.
Can you see my screen?
Yeah.
Okay, so hi, everyone. I'm going to talk about the AI Explainability 360 Toolkit. So this is a toolkit that can help explain data and machine learning models. And before I jump into the roadmap of where we are and where we want to go, just want to share a bit of background. So one of the goals that we had in mind when we were developing this toolkit is precisely what was being discussed earlier, that you know, different stakeholders in the AI value chain have different explainability requirements. So you know, be it a data scientist, you know, who wants to just understand the training data, or maybe wants to debug the model, or a domain expert who wants to understand the prediction of the model and you know, compare that with the domain knowledge he has, or maybe an end user who wants to sort of, you know, who is actually affected by the explanation itself. So each stakeholder has a different requirement for explanation. And so as part of the toolkit, we actually came up with a collection of 8 different explainability algorithms in the first release, and also 2 explanation metrics. Another goal was to, of course, you know, support a community of users, including practitioners, data scientists, and you know, machine learning researchers, to sort of help make models more transparent and explainable. And so with that in goal, we have a lot of educational material on this particular website, on the Bloomix website, where we have demos and you know, a lot of the tutorials. And we also have our videos listed there, and you know, also guidance charts, you know, on how different algorithms could be used by different users in what settings and so on. And other goals, of course, in terms of machine learning research, we wanted users to be able to compare different algorithms, you know, to see where the weakness is. And so all of that could be done, you know, simply by installing one particular toolkit. So those were the main goals we had in mind. We sort of, you know, released this toolkit. So currently we have about, 8 + 2 explainability algorithms. 8 algorithms have been implemented by us. We have integrated 2 algorithms in the version 0.2, 2 popular algorithms, LIME and SHAP. So they're available in the toolkit now. We have frozen certain versions of LIME and SHAP depending on the what versions of TensorFlow and other frameworks they're using. So in that version, we also had a couple of dependency updates and bug fixes and so on. In the version that we're going to sort of put in into PyPI this month, we have a couple of updates that had been made since the last release. So we have one minor update to the contrastive explanation method that Stacy was mentioning earlier, just a minor update in terms of how the parameters are passed to the algorithm. We have a new feature binarizer that's actually used with some of the directly interpretable explainers. It was actually contributed by one of the community members. We had minor updates to the directly interpretable models again based on the Pandas release that changed, and a couple of other updates to the the main finance tutorial we had, and also added a new abstraction class for global black box explainers. So that is currently in the pipeline for the current release this month on PyPI. In the future, the goal is to maximize community contributions. We have 3 main areas that we want to sort of contribute more on the toolkit. One is in terms of frameworks. So we want explainability to work on different frameworks, whether it's a PyTorch model or a TensorFlow model. So there is some work happening internally as well on that front. So, but we also welcome alternative implementations by other users for other frameworks. On the algorithms front, we have lined up a few algorithms that we want to sort of integrate first. For example, another algorithm called as Anchor from LIME, and a sort of a long list of algorithms we had in mind when we sort of built the toolkit. So that is another area to sort of contribute more algorithms. Metrics is a new area where we want to be able to, compare different algorithms, or, see how one algorithm compares with the other, because most of these algorithms are essentially best effort in nature. So they don't actually guarantee your correct explanation. So that's a That's an area of research that's quite active. So more metrics. And one other request from a lot of users was to sort of build a Conda package, and we'll probably do that. And also we want to sort of keep the notebooks in shape so that, you know, users don't face any difficulty. So we want to sort of somehow include the automated automate the testing of notebooks and Travis. So that's another thing we are trying. So that is the rough agenda for future as well. So happy to take any questions, any quick questions, or also happy to sort of pass off to the next speaker.
Thanks a lot, Vijay. Does anyone have any quick questions on this? I think so this is great. So there was a last topic we had on the agenda today where, you know, Andrew Butler, he has been contributing to Kubeflow serving, and he has, you know, provided an integration with AI Explainability 360 there. So we probably have 2 minutes left. So I believe, you know, this is probably a topic which we can bring up on the next agenda. Maybe, Andrew, if you have just one slide you want to highlight, and then in the next meeting, we will go with the full-fledged demo and how, you know, this can be used in the context of, you know, real-time inferencing systems. Yeah.
Sure, sounds good. As Animesh mentioned, this is for KO serving in the Kubeflow ecosystem. And I'll just briefly show these slides, but the general idea is you can take whatever model that you want and serve it inside of KF serving, whether that be through an image or through some object storage that has the model. And then you also can load up this explainer, which is in the green, the spec is in the green box, and it'll just, you can pick what type of explainer you want as long as it's supported, and not all of them are supported. We only have two currently, and we're working on one for the adversarial robustness toolbox as well, but that's not finished, whereas the AIX one is contributed. And the basic idea is anybody who has access to your Kubernetes cluster that the Kubeflow is running on can send a request to get an explanation for any example that you might have. So I guess that's up to my 2 minute boundary.
Yeah, so I think the thing to highlight, and, you know, this is something we will dive deeper into, you know, the next meeting, is that if you have these models running in production and, you know, you want real-time explanations as the requests are coming in, or, you know, you want real-time adversarial detection, bias detection, which is more focused on the last leg of the life cycle, you know, when models are actually, you know, running live, predicting, how do you actually enable them? In that context, so that's the work, you know, which we are driving with the Kubeflow community. So it will be great to see and get inputs from others. So with that, I think we are at the top of the time. Thanks everyone for joining. Thanks, Stacy, Piat, Vijay, Sam, and Andrew for, you know, updates on these things. I think, you know, this is a very exciting field. And hopefully, you know, as we expand and go into the next meetings, we can start talking about also, you know, more advanced use cases and implementations, which we are seeing, right? So just like, you know, Stacy did today, you know, hopefully we can also get, you know, from other toolkits, what they are seeing in terms of, you know, real world implementations in the industry, vis-a-vis around, you know, let's say bias or adversarial robustness. That would be great. And Jacob, it will be great to get your email right. I mean, we would love to see, you know, the areas where you think, you know, from a consumption and usability perspective, there can be some improvements made. And I would say Will and, you know, Jacob and Hiram, thanks for joining, from General Motors and Microsoft perspective. It's great to see, you know, more and more participation on these tools. Thanks again, guys.
Thanks, Animesh.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.